Jesus had come to Capernaum after being across the lake and dealing with the demoniacs and all the pigs that went in the lake. He'd come back and healed the paralytic. And now he was in his own hometown in Capernaum. And of all the people that the disciples and anyone surrounding them, the one person they would probably never have ever believed would come to Jesus for anything would have been Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue. Synagogue rulers were very special people. They were the ultra-conservative, orthodox leaders of the synagogue. They weren't the preachers. They were the arrangers. They were the ones that took care of all the... They did the order service. They decided who was going to preach, what the things that were going to go on in the synagogue. And not only did they have a lot of to say about the worship service in the synagogue, they also took care of the building. They were responsible for everything about that synagogue. And it was these men, rulers of synagogues in Israel, who were probably the most dangerous enemies that Jesus had. They did not like Jesus because he represented everything that they didn't stand for. He was breaking traditions. He was doing strange things. He was teaching things that were odd, sounded odd and out of kilter to them and their belief systems. He certainly was powerful and did miracles, but was he really the Messiah or just a pretender? He didn't really fit their picture of who the Messiah would be, a glorious king who came in power and might to destroy the Romans, their enemies, and shoo them out of the land and basically take over the world. No, he was just a little fisherman from upcountry Nazareth. A fisherman. He wasn't a fisherman. He was a carpenter from upcountry Nazareth. And he had around, hanging around him, a bunch of fishermen from the local fishing fleet at Capernaum. No great big deal. But Jairus was in a little bit of a pickle. He had a daughter that he loved dearly, really deeply loved this daughter. And he and his wife were just beside themselves when this daughter became sick. They had the money and the influence and the means to get the very best medical attention you could possibly get in that time, in that age. They tried everything. Everything. And this poor little girl kept going down, down, down. Until finally, she was so sick and so near death's door that Jairus swallowed his pride and decided that the lesser of two evils, the greater good would be served if he would go to his enemy and see if he would have compassion on his daughter and heal her. So he went. And I can just imagine, this is not a huge town, Capernaum. And there's history tells us there's only one synagogue in town. And all of these people knew this guy. They knew who he was. And they saw him coming. And they're going, uh-oh, what's he up to? Something big trouble coming down. No, no, no. He didn't come for trouble. He came and fell at the feet of Jesus and begged him, pleaded earnestly, we read in Mark 5:23, earnestly with him, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. I'm amazed at Jesus' response. Well, not really amazed, but amazed that his response probably wouldn't have been mine. This is my enemy. This is the kind of guy that's trying to make my life miserable. I'm the last person in the world you'd ever expect for him to come for anything. Now I've got my chance. I could maybe grill him a little bit. I could maybe make him squirm a little bit and say, well, maybe I'll come and maybe I won't. Not Jesus. Disciples, I'm sure, were running through their head. Well, you know, is he really going to go? What's he going to do? What's he going to do? This is the most unbelievably wonderful thing about Jesus in all the Gospels. He never questioned a person's request. This was a plea from the heart of a father, not from the cold heart of a ruler who was against him in many other areas. And the Bible simply says Jesus went with him. Didn't argue, didn't make any snide, cynical, or caustic comments, didn't say anything, just went with him. And so here he is on the way to the house of this ruler, all the people in the crowd that could see anything and heard anything kind of heard the conversation. And while the man was making his plea, and just before they were ready to go, a messenger came and whispered in the ear of the ruler and said, "Your daughter died. Don't bother the master. He doesn't need to come. It's no use." And he knelt and said to Jesus, "Now she's died. Will you come so she can live?" And Jesus got up and he went. Hope against hope. On the way, a huge crowd gathered, wanting to see what was going to happen. I mean, this is exciting news, and I can imagine that the news of the ruler, Jairus, coming to Jesus for help went like wildfire through the crowd. Everybody knew what was going on. They knew where they were going, and it was like a magnet. People came from everywhere. They want to see what he's going to do. On the way, in the crowd, people pushing around him and jostling, and he doesn't have a bodyguard. The disciples were the people all around him, pushing and shoving, and he's making his way, and they're trying to get through the crowd. All of a sudden, Jesus just stops cold. And for a moment, everything was suspended. And he cried out in a loud voice, "Who touched me?" And it got real quiet. And the disciples said, "What do you mean, who touched you? People are touching you all around." "No," he said, "I felt virtue. Something left me. Someone touched me." And he looked over the crowd, and he looked. And finally, this woman sort of makes her way through the crowd, and Jesus reaches out for her, and she comes forward. She said, "I did." This woman was a desperate woman. She lived with a disease or a condition that was almost as bad as leprosy, in the sense that it cut you off from all social activity of any kind. She bled, and it was a uterine bleed. And for 12 years, she had gone to doctors. The Talmud sets out no fewer than 11 different cures for this condition. One of the most ridiculous ones is to carry the ashes of an ostrich egg in a linen bag in the summer and a cotton bag in the winter. It's really kind of silly. All kinds of things they did. And Mark, as he tells it, makes it clear that this woman had tried everything. She'd gone to every doctor. She had spent all her money. And what the bottom line for her was, she was worse, not better. And just imagine for a moment this woman. 12 years she's been bleeding. She's probably anemic, pale, not real strong. She lives on the edges of society. She's sort of a castaway because everything she touches is unclean. If anyone touches her, they got to go through the ceremony of being clean. Sometimes takes days to do it. Nobody wanted to touch her. She didn't feel the touch of the warmth of humanity. No one touched her. No one hugged her. All of her dreams have turned to ashes. Her life is useless. She has nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to love, no one to care for, and no one to love and care for her. It was a pretty hopeless situation. Then she heard of a physician, a new kind of physician. His name was Jesus of Nazareth. And he was different than all the rest of the physicians she'd ever known. He didn't charge anything. He was free. And he was effective. She'd heard the stories about the different healings that he had done, and she was particularly taken by the healing of a leper and knowing that Jesus had touched a leper. If he could touch a leper, he could touch her. And so we're told that she came to where Jesus was. And not a lot of people must have known her, because if they had known her, they would have moved, like for the leper, out of the way. But here she is, this unclean woman, sneaking around in the crowd, trying to get to Jesus. And she tries once, and she tries twice. And finally, she's so desperate, she says, "If only I can touch the fringe of his robe." Now, every good Jew had these four fringes. They were tassels. And it was probably that which she touched. And she just finally, just like a needle piercing the skin, you know, just she stuck her hand through the crowd and she grabbed the tassel. And she could feel the new life coursing through her body. The strength and the vitality that came to her. And she was thrilled. All she wanted to do was just slip away. Just slip away. Jesus wouldn't let her. You see, Jesus didn't want two things he wanted. He wanted to bless her. He wanted to say to her that she was healed, that he knew it, and that he blessed her and honored her faith. But secondarily, I believe that he didn't want her to think, or anyone else to think, that somehow he was a magic cloth. There was some, it could turn to superstition. Just touch the fringe. You know, who knows? People might have liked to tried to sneak up and cut his tassels and send them off to others so they could be healed by just touching the tassels. They could have a tassel touching ministry. It's not uncommon. We have handkerchief ministries today. They bless them, they send them to you, and they'll heal you. It's not to say God doesn't use those means. It's just to say that God goes much farther than that. God is a personal God. He wants to deal with us individually and personally. And I'm thankful for that. And so ended her encounter with Jesus. And then everything picked up where it left off. And now they're on their way to the house of Jairus. Now, when they got to the house, what they found was something that is strange to us. And we've spoken about this before. But I want to speak about it again, because it's so out of sync with anything we know when it comes to funeral rituals and rites and traditions. And Barclay, in his commentary, makes a very interesting statement about funeral customs in Jesus' day. First of all, their mourning customs were very vivid and detailed, and practically all of them were designed to stress the desolation and the final separation of death. A triumphant, victorious hope of the Christian faith was totally absent. I heard that yesterday. And it makes me a little bit sad. Immediately when a person would die, a loud wailing was set up. And in every town, there were people who were professional wailers. And we're not talking about, oh, boo-hoo-hoo. We're talking about, ah, all kinds of screaming and noise. It's been a long time since I've heard wailing and people just grieving out loud in a loud manner. It happened a few months ago when this young man died down on Highway 49, and all the family were gathered. It was about, I don't know, 20, 30 people there, and they got the official word that the boy, it was his body and it was him. And there was a weeping and a wailing that came forth. It just sort of set me back because I hadn't seen it for a while. It impacts you. You can't escape from it. Not that you necessarily want to, but it's very impactful. And this whole grieving process was designed to impact. So when death took place, this wailing started. It went on for days. It didn't go on for days, because they buried you within a day, 24 hours or less. And they would beat their breasts, they would tear their hair, they'd rent their garments. There were special rules about rending garments. If you were a family member, you were supposed to rend it from here to the heart. If you weren't, you did it on the right side. If you were a woman, you would go in private and rend your inner garment, and then you would take it and turn it around, and then you'd rend your outer garment so it was open here. After a few days, you had to sew it up with a rough sew, and it had to be like that for 30 days. At the end of 30 days, you could repair the garment and make it the way it was supposed to be. They took this very, very seriously. And it was also a process that had no hope in it. It was truly grieving. You know, Jesus said, grieve not as others do. We don't have to do this stuff. We have a hope that is unbelievably powerful and promises that are beyond our imagination. Flute players. The Bible tells us in Mark there were flute players there. Flutes were associated with death. In fact, they were so powerful and moved people so much that the Romans made a law that no Roman could be buried and have more than 10 flutes playing at the funeral, because it would be so loud and so affect people so much. This was what Jesus walked into when he got to the ruler's house. Scripture tells us that. It tells us that a large crowd followed him. When he entered the ruler's house, verse 23 of Matthew 9, and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep. And they laughed at him, mocked him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and he said, and she got up. Just think for a minute what this family had to do. The girl was still dead. They were in the midst of what tradition told them what to do. This was the ruler of the synagogue, the man who did everything by the book. And he now, along with his wife, has to tell all these people to leave. A tremendous breach of etiquette and tradition. This man was desperate for his daughter to live, beyond what we even know. And then Jesus, taking only Peter, James, and John, goes into the room where the girl was. He took the child's father and mother, this is in Mark 5, verse 40, and the disciples who were with him, and it was Peter, James, and John, and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha cum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. And of course, as he'd done before, he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. How in the world do you hide a girl that was dead and is now alive? Pretty tough. Pretty tough. You think there was joy in that home? You think they had any qualms about firing the mourners and the flute players? I don't think so. You think they fixed up their robes and their rents and their garments? You bet they did. There was joy in that house. There was joy in this woman who had been healed on the way. She had a life. She could touch people. She could be touched. She had a life. God gave her her life back. These men, Jesus gave this family their child's life back. There's one other small piece. There are three events that happened right together. And the third one is a little different. It's only found, I think it's only found in Matthew. Yes. No. I think it's Mark. Just got to find it. Anyway, it's two blind men. And they cry out to Jesus, Son of David, heal us. Now, you won't find Jesus being called Son of David very often, if at all, other than this particular instance. And he never referred to himself as the Son of David. You know why? By the way, all three of these stories have something in common, which we'll come to in a moment. You see, the term Son of David was the term that was applied to the messianic understanding of the Jews of that time, that the Son of David, the king, would come and destroy the Romans. These men did not understand who Jesus was. They were convinced in some way, shape, or form that he was the Messiah that was going to rule. They were verbalizing what other people had only thought, because Jesus discouraged it. And they're calling out to him in public, Son of David, and Jesus doesn't respond to them at all. He doesn't, you know, we don't know what they were up to. And if you notice what he does, he waits till he's in the house. And then they come to him in the house, privately. And in the house, he asks them, what do you want? What do you really want? They wanted to be healed. And Jesus healed them. Now, what is there in common with these stories? What is there in common? First, the ruler. There is no doubt that the ruler came to Jesus when everything else had failed. He was the pillar of Jewish orthodoxy in that town. He was part of the group, one of the men that despised and hated Jesus. They'd be glad to see him eliminated. No doubt he had tried every doctor, we've already alluded to that, every kind of cure. And only in sheer, absolute, total desperation, as a last, the very last of the last resorts, he comes to see Jesus. That is to say, he came to him with what we might call an inadequate motive. He did not come to Jesus out of the outflow of love in his heart. He came to Jesus because he had tried everything and everyone else, and because there was nowhere else to go. This man came to Jesus simply because desperation drove him there. The woman with the issue of blood crept up behind Jesus in the crowd and touched the hem of his cloak. And we, looking on, not knowing anything else about the story, looking on with maybe a bit of detachment and criticism, a critical awareness, we kind of look at that woman and think that she was actually acting on nothing other than superstition. You know, in some ways, to touch the edge of Jesus' cloak is not a whole lot different than looking for healing power in relics and handkerchiefs and other things of saints and so forth. This woman came to Jesus with what we might call a little inadequate faith. She had faith, but what was it in? The two blind men, they were crying out to Jesus, "Have pity on us, you son of David," and that was not a title Jesus desired. They didn't know what he was all about. So they came to Jesus with an inadequate conception of who he was. They saw in him no more than the conquering hero of David's line. And even though the ruler came with an inadequate motive, the woman came with maybe inadequate faith, the blind men came with inadequate theology, yet they found Jesus' love and power waiting for their needs. And here's the most wonderful thing of all. It does not matter how we come to Jesus, only that we come. No matter how inadequate and how imperfectly we come, his love and his arms are open to receive us. There are two lessons here. It means that we do not wait to ask Christ's help until our motives, our faith, our theology are perfect. Amen? We may come to him exactly as we are. And it means that we have no right to criticize others whose motives we believe to be mistaken, whose faith is weak, or their theology is wrong. It is not how we come to Christ that matters. It is that we should come at all. For he is willing to accept us as we are and to make able to make us what we ought to be. Do you think the ruler was changed? I believe he was. Do you think the woman was changed? Yes. Do you think those two blind men were changed? Yes. You cannot encounter Jesus that personally and not be changed. You can't. You just can't. So how about us? Do we sometimes hang around the edges of miracles because we don't think we're faithful enough? Or that our motives aren't pure? Or that somehow our theology may not be correct? When we look at healing, and we talk, and this has been a hot subject in this area recently because of Kelly, but we look at healing, we look at praying to God. What do we look for? What's important? What's God concerned about? He's not concerned about us having everything straight. What he's concerned about is that we come to him. You know, God is able to straighten out the crooked. He's able to heal the brokenhearted, to give comfort to the sick. God can do anything, but we have to come to him in order for him to do it. Have you ever found yourself in your life having a problem that was overwhelming and using every resource that you have to solve the problem, everything you know to do, every person you know to contact, pull every string that you know about, and finally you get to the end of your rope and say, well, I, I guess I'll ask God. How are we any different than the ruler who came to Jesus? How is that any different? It's not. Who should be the first one that we talk to when we have a problem? It's Jesus. Sometimes our busyness and our desire to solve our own problems actually make the problems worse. Look at the woman with the 12 years of bleeding. Now, Jesus wasn't there that whole 12 years, obviously. But everything she tried just made it worse. Is that to say that we don't use other means than prayer? No. No, not at all. Not at all. What it does mean is we do not use other means without prayer. That our primary resource, the place we turn to first, our first thought in a crisis, our first thought when we get news from a doctor that we have cancer, our first thought when we hear our child has been in an automobile accident, our first thought when we find out we have a pink slip on our paycheck, our first thought is God. Our first thought is God. And say, God, I don't know what to do. You're going to have to do it. We are so prone to falling back on our own skills and our own resources and our own abilities that we oftentimes, and sometimes we'll pray, we'll say, oh God, you know, I got this problem, thank you, and we work on it. I think I learned this. It's taken me a long time. I've been making a list of things I knew, that things I've learned that I already knew. Any of you have that kind of list? Things I've learned that I already knew. It's hard. It is very difficult to not rely on the skills and abilities that God has given you when you walk into a situation or you're put in a situation that is fraught with risk. I used to think when I was a little younger that I knew a lot about a lot of things. And I found myself earlier when I was mediating, depending on my skill, I'd get in a crisis with somebody and I said, well, I've been trained for this and I've been trained for that and I can do this and I can do that. And I just walk in and do it. I don't do that anymore. I don't dare. I don't dare do that anymore. I went a couple Sabbaths ago. Some of you know that I went to this family up here in Wildwood. There were like 20 or 30 people there. And I didn't have a clue. And it was really funny what God did, because I had all this stuff on grief that I'd pulled off, I was going to take with me. And it got left. I didn't have anything. I had nothing. I went there with nothing. I had my Bible and that was all. Well, that's not bad, but I didn't have anything with me. I couldn't even remember the grief cycle. Sorry, Derry, I just never memorized it. And I got there, and as I was driving there, I said, God, you know, you've given me a lot of skill, and there's a lot of things I know, but I have no idea what to do. I'm not about to step into this and decide what comes next. You're going to have to prompt me about what to do next. And I was amazed. And I've been amazed every time, because he always has done it. Every time I've walked in to be with people in a crisis, I've always asked God. In recent years, I've said, God, I do not know what to do in this situation. Oh, sure, there's things out here I know what to do, but not here, not now. I don't know. I don't know these people. I don't know anything about them. And God gives me what to say. I can't even remember what I said to those people. But I know they were blessed. They told me they were. And I enjoyed them. They were wonderful people. What I'm trying to say is that's just a small, tiny little illustration of how we live life in God's lane. We either live it in God's lane or our lane. And living life and dealing with issues and problems is about God. Yeah, I know a doctor. I know good doctors. Got one right here. I know that they have skill. I know all of these things. I know that I should do this and this and this in this crisis. But before I do anything, I want to submit everything to you. I want you to be the one standing behind me, guiding me as I walk through this path and this maze. I don't want to take blind alleys. I don't want to end up at dead ends. I want to be exactly in the middle of your road and your will. And as I am in your road, as I am in your will, that what you bring to me, what you open up before me, is the right thing to do. Does that mean I check my brain out? No. But it means I reason together with God. And he guides me. And every single one of us have that. And it doesn't make any difference if you don't have a lot of faith. If your motives aren't pure. Or if your theology is wrong, according to some people. You just come to Jesus.